Going to just take our usual division action on the initiatives. We didn't have bill numbers in front of us on Tuesday, but we're not going to discuss them further unless people would like to, or if anyone in the audience would like to comment, that's fine. The Office of Higher Education is currently presenting in the House, and we anticipate them coming to our committee meeting around 2 o'clock, so we may have to move the agenda around a little bit in order to accommodate their House schedule. So, Senator Senjum, if you want to join the president, make a few comments about Senate Bill 901.
Thank you, Mr. President, and Madam President, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair.
And members, it's a pleasure and honor to be here today to speak on behalf of the HEPR budget, HEPR being Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement. And this is something that we routinely try to do nearly every year in terms of keeping our structures and facilities up to date and adequate. I believe the President mentioned the other day that we have 28 million square feet of surface within the university system. That's an awful lot of space. And an awful lot of facility, and obviously that it does need to be maintained and kept in a style and a function that's certainly appropriate to the mission of education. So, Madam President, the bill is for $22 million system-wide. There is a handout here that reflects a little bit about it in terms of the general needs being code compliance, infrastructure repairs, and so on. Referral to support existing programs, or renewal rather, to support existing programs. And these are largely, in many cases, these repairs and improvements are made in the area of health and safety. In Minnesota, it seems as everywhere we go on the bonding trip, it's a problem with water, and the university is no exception to that. So water infiltration, be it roofs or lower levels of buildings, is often an issue, and of course, building systems. The third page, I believe, that's the third page, reflects table that...
Wait a minute, I need to know what... I'm not sure what you're looking at.
I'm sorry, this document here.
Is this a document that we have?
A document, Driven to Discover.
I think the slides are also on the screen.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Right.
But the amounts by campus, Madam Chair and members, are reflected there. Crookston at $250,000. Duluth at $1.39 million, Morris at $710,000, regional centers $250,000, and the Twin City campus $19.4 million. So, Madam President, members, that is the essence of the HEPR request, and I'd certainly entertain any comments that university staff has.
Sorry that I didn't know where we were following along here. Any questions from the committee? Mr. President, any comments?
No, I don't have any other comments. This is obviously, except to say, this is obviously a very, very important work that is funded by this request. And I think there's another slide here just to kind of, no, is that the one? No, the one with the bar charts. Do you have that one?
The last one.
Okay, the last one.
This one.
Well, that shows basically the sort of the history of requests and appropriations, and this is always an area where we have less money than we obviously need, and some of that has to do with the age of the buildings. And
President Brunix, how much did you request last year, and how much did you get from the legislature?
We requested $80 million, and I think the appropriation, the final appropriation, was $30
million. Mm-hmm.
And it's just a continuous need. I'm sure you see the same thing with the Minsky request, and it's vitally important, and I hope we can get some support out of the legislature this year.
It seems to me historically that everyone gets more excited about individual building projects than about the, you know, kind of the roofs and the HVAC. And I don't know how – I know the backlog is something like $450 million or $500 million, something like
that. It's probably pretty close to that, and we have a very disciplined process for setting priorities. We do a facilities condition assessment review of all of our buildings every year and then set priorities according to urgency. And we often are constantly scrambling to appropriate our own money. This year, for example, we raised and taxed the balances to fund about $35 million of renewal because Northrop Auditorium had a roof that was beginning to leak, and if those leaks had found their way into the interior of the structure, it would have cost us a fortune to fix it. So, you know, so part of it is work that we try to do on our own, too.
President Brunix, what would happen if we just had a few cycles where the university only requested HEPRA and didn't request new buildings, so there was no competition there?
Chair Pappas, I don't think that would be a good strategy for the university for a number of reasons. The building requests are not just for new buildings. Many of those requests, for example, I think our top priority next time will replace a building that was never finished, the science classroom building. It supports 50 majors on the Twin Cities campus. And other requests do major remodeling. They're not HEPA requests, but they go through a whole building and restore a building like Falwell, one of the historic buildings on our campus. We're now spending some university money to stabilize the outside because we really couldn't wait for a HEPA request or a regular bonding request. But I think for the University of Minnesota, I think we'd have to balance our request between remodeling buildings, new construction, and HEPA. So we think we have it about right.
Okay. No other questions?
Madam Chair, just maybe to your question earlier, I do have some numbers. In 2002, the request was $80 million and $35 million was granted. In 2004, $90 million and $40 million was granted. So obviously the point is we're always running behind in this area. So with that, if you would like a motion.
Yep. You want to send this to finance.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I would move that this HEPA request be adopted by the committee and referred to finance.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, thank you very much. Then, President Brunix, if you wanted to conclude with anything, and then we'll take action on all the other bills.
Yes, Chair Pappas, members of the committee, thanks again for inviting us back. I'd like to start by acknowledging three members of the university's Board of Regents who are here with us today. Regent Dallas Bonsack, to my right and your left, Regent Stephen Hunter, seated next to him, and then Regent David Metzen, I think, is somewhere behind me.
Welcome.
I want to thank them for coming. Do we have the summary chart? Let me just make a couple of comments by way of summary. We have tried to present a budget that we think is clearly ambitious, but one that we think really meets the true needs, the long-term needs of the University of Minnesota and the state of Minnesota. And we're strongly urging you as a committee, I'd like to come back and make some follow-up comments after other people have testified, but we're urging you to take a look at this budget. It funds the core operating expenses of the University of Minnesota. We call that sustaining quality and competitiveness. Unless you take care of those core expenses, the compensation of your faculty and staff, certain investments in the educational programs that benefit our students, and in technology and related infrastructure, it's pretty hard to keep the core operation of the university sound, competitive, and keep the quality that is necessary to support our students, faculty, and staff. This budget also asks that we stretch at the university and as a state to make some, I think, profoundly important investments in Minnesota's future. And these are investments in areas that I think and my colleagues believe are necessary to move the university forward, but I think more importantly to move our state forward, areas that relate to human health and the health workforce, areas that have to do with advancing science and engineering, particularly in relationship to Minnesota industries and our economy, areas that have to do with advancing research on the environment, food systems, and renewable energy. And that we called Creating Minnesota's Future. We think it's an exciting budget model or framework. We think the priorities represented in this budget are the right ones for the future of the University of Minnesota. And I think the architecture of this budget and the size of the request is very fitting in relationship to the state's financial situation, but I think also in relationship to the university's most recent budgetary experience over the last 4 years. If you approve this entire budget, we would still not be up to the level of state support that we had in the early years of this century. So I would urge the committee to give the request every possible consideration, and certainly as we take further testimony, we'll be available to answer any questions you may have on this proposal or any other aspect of the university.
Thank you. Thank you, President Brunix, and I appreciate you taking the time with us. Are there any questions from members of the committee for the president or anyone else? Then we're just going to do the very best we can for you, and I'm sure all the committee members are going to try real hard to get as much money as we can from Senator Cohen to our division.
Tough guy.
Okay, well, why don't we go through the and you can stay or you can leave, whatever
your
schedule
is. Yeah, I'll be happy to stay.
All right.
I'd be happy to make
I think we wanted, if you were going to be able to stay, we wanted to hear from the university after the governor's recommendations are presented.
Yeah, I have some additional comments I would like to make, but I think those ought to be presented to you before I make my comments.
Okay,
It'd work better, I think.
Great, and we're hoping that they'll get over here soon, but we may have to hear from the students first. Then Senator Tomassoni. Senate File 909.
I got a bill up today?
Yeah, you already presented your bill. You just have to make the motion because now we have the bill file number.
All right.
Is there anyone in the audience that wants to comment on any of the bills that are on the agenda that hasn't had a chance
to
do so? Unless you're a student and you're already on the agenda, then we'll get to you. Okay.
So then I move.
Yep.
What am I moving?
Laid over for consideration.
I'd like to move that Senate File 909 be laid on the table and be considered for inclusion in the omnibus education bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Cohen. Someone needs to go get Senator Cohen so he can make his motion. Senator Michelle.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd move that Senate File 928 be laid on the table and considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Sharon.
Chairwoman Pappas, I move that Senate File 930 be laid on the table and referred to the education omnibus bill for consideration.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Lynch.
Chair Pappas, I move that Senate File 932 be laid on the table for consideration in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 931 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. We'll postpone action on Senator Cohen's bill until he gets here. Then we'll take some testimony from the University of Minnesota student and faculty organization, starting with Will Durfee from Mechanical Engineering. Is Will here?
So you think she'll do that?
Cool. Chair Pappas, Senators, I have a statement that I would like to read. It'll take about 3 minutes or so. That's all right. My name is Will Durfee. I'm Professor and Director of Design Education in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the U, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to address the committee. I came to the U in 1993 from Boston. I live in the Edina in the district of Senator Michelle. I teach and do research in mechanical engineering, but my interests are broad. Along with my mechanical engineering duties, I participate in the faculty governance system, and as with my colleagues Nancy Carpenter and Martin Sampson, who you'll hear from in a minute, I'm on the faculty consultative committee whose task is to advise senior university administrators on matters related to faculty. On Tuesday, President Brunix mentioned the university initiative to bring writing instruction to the departments. I'm running the pilot for this in mechanical engineering because we want to be sure that all mechanical engineers graduating from the University of Minnesota write well. 2 weeks ago, I was in Eden Prairie teaching 95th graders about simple machines, including some of the simple machines I use in my research. Last Thursday, I was on my hands and knees at the Junlun Theater doing the wiring on the electric motors to drive the full-size car you'll see in the upcoming production of Don Giovanni, because my PhD student Ian Burt and myself know something about robotics, and were asked by the Junlun to help them figure out how to get their car to move. Why should the state of Minnesota invest $67 million for regular compensation and $28.5 million for competitive compensation in this biennium? These are the two parts of the parts of the university's request to sustain quality and to create Minnesota's future. I'll try to answer this question in the context of my department, mechanical engineering. Our department is number 8 in the country by the last National Research Council ranking. Our goal is to be one of the top 3 public departments of mechanical engineering in this country. We can get there because we have extraordinary faculty and because we have extraordinary students. For example, Professor Uwe Kortschagen is laying down nanoparticles at high temperatures to manufacture new types of solar panels that will be an order of magnitude more efficient than current technologies. Professor Art Erdman is working with several local companies to create next-generation medical devices. Professor Perry Lee is in our $21 million Fluid Power Research Center and is developing a key technology that will lead to hydraulic hybrid automobiles that are even more fuel efficient than electric hybrids. These are the faculty that we need to retain, and these are the characteristics of the new faculty that we'll have to hire over the next 5 years to grow and to replace the large numbers of faculty that are close to retirement. Mechanical engineering is not like hockey. The Gophers can put together a world-class hockey team recruiting solely from within Minnesota. This is how it should be in Hockey Nation. However, to be world-class in mechanical engineering, we must compete on the world stage. To bring in the very best faculty, our searches are international. Other universities are continually trying to lure our very best faculty away with lucrative salary and resource offers. It was a blow to our department when Professor Brad Nelson, one of the top stars in robotics, was snapped up by ETH Zurich in Switzerland to lead a major research center. But how does recruiting and retaining top faculty impact our core mission to educate undergraduates to be tomorrow's engineers? Our undergraduates receive an excellent education because faculty in my department place a high priority on teaching. As evidence, one can look to the number of teaching awards given to our department faculty. As an example of what our students learn in my introduction to engineering course, every one of the 200 students designs and constructs a computer-controlled machine that does something interesting and presents it in a large public event. We have our students do that because the modern mechanical engineer must be trained in mechatronics, which is the merger of mechanics, computers, and electronics that pervades modern products from iPods to Coke machines to automobiles. This course has been cloned at Century College, and we are working with Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College to put pieces of the course into their emerging pre-engineering program, which we hope will bring more Minnesota American Indian students into engineering. But at a research university, classroom teaching is only part of the story of how students are educated. Having top research faculty opens extraordinary education opportunities for not only our graduate but also our undergraduate students. Take, for example, Matt Sellner, an undergrad mechanical engineering student who's working with me and Dr. Rob Sweet using some of the investment money for the Medical Simulation Training Center that's in the Health Workforce and Clinical Sciences request presented by President Brunix on Tuesday. Matt is working on a project that we call Every Medical Student Gets a Beating Heart. The Beating Heart is a simple take-home lab kit that contains a life-size mechanical human heart simulator that, when connected to the student's home computer, pulses and beats with the rhythms of a normal or diseased heart. The idea is that medical students and nurses will gain a deeper understanding of arrhythmias if they can hold a beating heart in their hands. Or take Jessica Holst, an undergraduate student in biomedical engineering who is using our motion capture system purchased through a National Science Foundation grant that is funding collaborative work between the departments of clothing design, mechanical engineering, and kinesiology. Jessica is measuring how Gopher varsity hockey players skate on a treadmill compared to skating on real ice in hopes of coming up with new training paradigms that will continue Gopher dominance in hockey. Then there is Alex Kosit, an undergraduate student in mechanical engineering working with me and Dr. Manoj Monga from urologic surgery. He's designing and building an apparatus that measures the effectiveness of a surgical technique to break up kidney stones so that when you have your stones removed at University Hospital, you'll get out of there faster and with less pain. Alex is one of our most outstanding students in our department, and last year received a very prestigious Astronaut Scholarship Foundation Award that will fund his current research project. I have the pleasure of having him in my system dynamics course right now, and he's so good that he's had to give him 101 out of 100 on the first quiz. That is what a research university is all about, with top-notch faculty doing top-notch research, with top-notch graduate and undergraduate students. Together we can produce the best and brightest human capital needed by the state of Minnesota. I personally am thrilled that students like Alex want to attend the University of Minnesota. If the university loses its support from the state and is no longer able to recruit and retain top faculty, then its research program will slowly degrade towards mediocrity. And because research and education are inextricably mixed, so will the education program move towards that hated Minnesota phrase, "Oh, it's good enough." Once we reach that point, we will lose students like Alex to the MITs and Michigans of the world, where they are unlikely to come back to the state. So in conclusion, it's for this reason that in my role as a university professor and in my role as a citizen of Minnesota, I ask you to support the full University of Minnesota biennial budget request. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Professor Durfee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Professor, I want to say thank you for your testimony. I know you sat through our earlier meeting this week, and I wonder if could you use Senator Tomasoni on the skating treadmill at all? I don't know if that would give you any good research background.
Pappas, Senator Michelle, we're willing to take anyone as research subjects who's willing to come over to you.
Senator Michelle would
Senator Tomasoni would
give him old hockey player results. Right now I'm living in the past, so I don't want to change it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nancy Carpenter. I do see that Frank Serra has now joined us, so if people do have any questions about the bioscience request, he is here. Hi. Ms. Carpenter.
All right. Chair Pappas and Senators, I wanted to thank you very much for this opportunity to visit with you today. I am Nancy Carpenter, an associate professor of chemistry at the Morris campus. I came to Minnesota in 1989 to teach at UMM after several years working and schooling in Chicago and Southern California. My daily routine revolves around my undergraduate students. I teach organic chemistry lecture and lab to budding doctors and scientists, as well as guide undergraduate research assistants developing new molecules and studying environmental chemistry problems. I have long known Minnesota as a progressive state with a strong commitment to excellence in higher education. To work at the Morris campus, among the top five national public liberal arts colleges for several years now, has been a real blessing for me. We serve terrific students, including a high proportion, about 22%, of students of color. The diversity that the Morris campus brings to West Central Minnesota is a real boon to the region. Our graduates do research at Mayo, work in the U.S. Department of State's Office of Global Change. They teach high school students all over the state, and are doctors, legislators, inventors, and authors. Above all, they are ambassadors who help cement our excellent reputation as a model liberal arts institution in the University of Minnesota system. Like all in the university system, UMM has devoted enormous effort to the strategic positioning process and towards clarifying our mission for the 21st century, a mission which is dedicated to serving our region and state. We have already developed strong collaborations with our community, such as our regional fitness center and our shared football facility. We are widely involved in civic engagement. Outreach to our community spans everything from children's theatrical productions to exciting science demonstrations for area third graders. In November of 2006, our Center for Small Towns was awarded the Carter Partnership Award, along with the City of Morris, for our campus community collaboration. Our vision for the future includes, for example, partnerships with institutions around the state to further our progress in the development of renewable energy. Our campus is already recognized as a national leader in green energy. Despite flat or decreasing operating budgets, cuts in positions, and a Native American student tuition waiver, which adds a burden of approximately $1 million to our budget every year, the Morris campus will continue to contribute to the bright future for the state of Minnesota. Our liberal arts mission provides an ideal template for developing the critical thinking skills our students need to solve the interdisciplinary problems of healthcare, the environment, and whatever the future may hold. But we need your continuing support. Thank you for letting me have this opportunity.
Well, and thank you for making the trip here from Morris. It really is a wonderful campus, and I certainly enjoyed my visit there. Yeah, it's a very special place. Any questions for Professor Carpenter? Okay, thank you. Professor Sampson, Martin Sampson.
Senator Pappas, members of the committee, my name is Martin Sampson. I'm the faculty liaison to the legislature. I'm also in the political science department in the Twin Cities, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be here. As I've listened in various contexts over the past couple of years to people talk about what they see the university doing, I've noticed that many people say that the U of M plans to become one of the top three research universities in the world. One hears this left and right, quote, top three research universities, end quote. Somehow, for some reason, the adjective public seems to get lost in the shuffle. For me as a faculty member, the adjective public matters. It matters a lot. A public research university, as we know it, is an ingenious American invention. It's an institution whose faculty, in Minnesota's case, bring in hundreds of millions of dollars of research grants every year, provide many kinds of service to the state, and are dedicated to a vast and complex teaching mission. The portfolio of the public research university is far, far more complicated than the portfolio of the private research university. And Minnesota needs us to excel at every part of that responsibility. More than half of my department is people starting their careers. One of them won the 2006 American Political Science Association Award for the best PhD study of Congress. And quickly, Harvard invited her for a job interview. Harvard invited also two other of our young faculty people in the past year for job interviews. So did Berkeley, Williams College, Columbia, MIT, Purdue, Northwestern, and George Washington. And we're not that big a department. Preventive retention funds have held most of that off. But note that on this list, there are only two public research universities. We lost a brilliant faculty member to Northwestern a couple of years ago, and we will be losing one of our very best teachers and most promising faculty to George Washington this year, both of those also being private research universities. Last month and in late December, from 36 countries, our PhD program received 278 applications. We, yesterday afternoon, admitted 30 of those people. We are aiming for an incoming class of 15. Without exceptional graduate students, there's no way we can hold, let alone recruit, exceptional young faculty. And without exceptional faculty, we're not going to have the best students from all over the world applying to us. Undergraduate program, well, we're 34 faculty. We support someplace between 700 and 800 majors in political science, plus many people who are not majors who take our courses. Last year, 262 students graduated from our major. Two of those won national awards. One, a Truman Award, which is one of the most prestigious awards. The other, a Rhodes Scholarship, which is probably the most prestigious award available to American undergraduates. Survey of graduating seniors last June reported that 70% of our people who were in that sample had completed their college work in 4 years. The survey the previous year was 75% having completed their work in 4 years. So what are we doing in the wake of this 2006 record? Well, what we're doing is we're recasting our major. We're building in more writing. We're building in more research opportunities, and we're making it easier to meet requirements. Why? It's not part of any national rankings. None of the people that do the rankings look at these kinds of details, as far as I know. It is part of our mission as a public research university, and it's part of our quest for overall excellence. There's been some discussion earlier in this committee about textbooks. Let me quickly throw in something about books. The book situation varies by academic field. Students in my 8:15 a.m. Senior level 4-credit course on U.S. policy toward the Middle East are paying on an average $12 a book. They're asked to read 7 books. Amazon.com sells those books, including shipping, for $83. None qualifies as a textbook. I got a flyer for a textbook the other day. It's an American foreign policy textbook, costs $60, 500 pages. I'm in a field where I can avoid using those kinds of things. These students are also asked to read scholarly articles. There's something like 25 scholarly periodical articles. In the old days, people would go to Kinko's and pay a fair chunk of money for copyright permissions plus the copying and so forth. Well, not anymore. Now they get them for free. They log on to the University of Minnesota Library's e-journal system, download it, and here's access to wonderfully current, very high-quality information available at no cost to them. This support of students, of course, depends on a first-rate library that can pay the very expensive e-subscription fees for journals. And library costs are rising very sharply. That is part of why the $24.9 million that the university is asking for under sustaining quality and competitiveness is very important. That request is going to help us as well with enhanced writing programs, better advising for undergraduates, and a number of other things. As I understand, this is not in the governor's request, and as a faculty member, it's my own view that, in fact, it's very, very important that this be fully funded, and we urge you to fully fund this part of the U's request. We also urge that you fund the $67 million for salary increases that's in the sustaining quality and competitiveness request of the U, which I think is also not in the governor's budget. For most faculty, salary increases are merit-based. Have a great year and you do well. Have a flat year and you do not do well. This is a kind of challenge system. It's a challenge system that reaches through all parts of the U's mission, and it works on the micro level, where performance hits the road. It needs the full $67 million. There's a pattern of public research universities falling behind private research universities' salaries. I recently looked at a 2006 list of the top 30 universities ranked by salary. Of the top 15, 13 are private research universities. Of the bottom 15, 12 are public research universities. The only public research universities in the top 15 are two California universities, Berkeley and UCLA. You know, we all compete for the same faculty, and we really need that $67 million in order to continue doing so. A very fair question surfaces, namely, where is the money going to come from? It's a fair question. There's a companion fair question. The companion fair question is how are the best American public research universities going to stay at the top if, in fact, state contributions in real dollars diminish generation by generation while costs are rising? Last evening, I looked at the Shanghai 2006 ratings of the top 500 universities in the world. It happens that these ratings ignore a lot of what we care deeply about. They're oblivious to quality of undergraduate education. They're not interested in service kinds of things. That said, of the top 50 universities in their rating of 500, 40 are U.S. universities. 17 of those, including the University of Minnesota, are public research universities. And if you look at that study, it's pretty clear that America has rolled into the beginning of this century in the driver's seat. My own question is whether 40 years hence there will still be any U.S. public research universities in the top 50 of world lists of these kinds. Are the best U.S. public research universities destined to lose their quality in this century because state and federal funding is so tight? If so, in our own case, that would cost Minnesota hundreds of millions of dollars in research grants. It would mean less in the way of innovation that's been so important for the economy of the state and for human well-being, and it would also reduce the quality of education. It's imperative, whatever happens elsewhere, that Minnesota not allow this to happen. The university's administration and the university's faculty are working very hard to protect and to deepen the excellence of the university. I understand it's not easy, but somehow, somewhere, someone has to find the political space for making significant state investment in this aspect of the future of Minnesota, just as Minnesotans did a generation ago. I urge that you fund the entire U of M request. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Does anyone have any questions for him? I have a question relative to the governor's performance bonus proposal. Have you had a chance to look at those?
Senator Roebling, I looked quickly at the various categories, and I noticed one of them, I think, is undergraduate graduation rates. I needed to go back because after I looked at them, I then asked myself the question, how many of these things, in fact, do pertain to undergraduate education? I think there's a roster, and if the university meets any three of those, then it gets the $25 million. My own, as I say, I need to go back and look at the list, but my own reaction is that we have a broader challenge and that every part of this challenge is very important. And that instead of $25 million of non-recurring funds, what we need is a larger amount of recurring investment in the university.
Mr. Sampson, do you think that the ones particularly that might pertain to the faculty, that they are attainable, like an increase in the percentage of national faculty awards in arts, humanities, science, engineering, and health of at least 5% over fiscal year 2007? And then to improve or maintain the university's rank and its national share of funding for the National Institutes of Health over 2007 levels, are those attainable and reasonable?
Senator Roebling, these are very short-term things, and I would have to defer to the deans and so forth of the various units that bring in a great deal of the funding. My own reaction is twofold. Part of it is facetious, but I'll share it anyway. The facetious part is people saying to each other, you know, as Minnesotans, we're not comfortable pounding our own drum, and we don't spend a lot of time nominating each other for awards that we could win, and that, in fact, there may be some potential along those lines if we would just get to work more energetically in trying to push nominations. That's the facetious part. The very serious part is that judging the university over the next year or two by how many awards are won is to judge the university on what kind of accomplishment has happened in the past couple of years, because that's then, you know, what is going to contribute to awards in the future. Merit-based pay is a brilliant way of doing that. The whole point about merit-based pay is that as people excel, you reward them more. And what a lot of people are unaware of is that under a merit-based system, if you have a year of no salary increases, as happened after the big budget cut a couple of years ago, or if you have a year of very modest salary increases, the most disadvantaged people in the whole university are exactly the people that had the most brilliant prior year. It's not a good way to run a railroad. It's not a good way to run a university. So it seems to me that, I mean, if you're asking, do I prefer the $25 million challenge or do I prefer the $67 million into faculty salaries plus the $24.9 million into sustaining, you know, undergraduate excellence, the investments are crucial.
I wasn't asking that question. I would have known your answer ahead of time.
I see. Okay. Right.
I was just asking about the attainability of the goals, actually. Right. Does anyone else have any questions? Senator Wieger.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Professor Sampson. Support the request. I do appreciate your reference to your own personal example on textbook costs, and since you brought it up, and maybe that was in response to me bringing it up. But I did just get a report this morning, and I think at the university for textbooks, it has gone up 23% in the past 3 years to an average cost of $900, though. There are other schools at a higher amount, but you set a good example, and hopefully that can be shared with others.
Chair Roebling, Senator Wieger, there are big differences among fields. And if one teaches in the area of U.S. policy toward the Middle East, the topic is continually shifting. There are new kinds of things surfacing. For some reason, good trade books are far less expensive than books that companies put out as textbooks. I'm sure there are a lot of fields that I could be teaching, I mean, that people teach in at universities where the instructor doesn't have that flexibility, where, in fact, you've really got to have a single major textbook. You can't change the content so readily of the curriculum and that you're locked in. And I do see it as a serious problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Cohen.
I'm sure, Professor Sampson, you talk about this question of performance review or additional compensation for performance. How's that reconciled with the region's professors? Maybe you're the wrong person to ask, but you know, there's been that internal program at the university for, I don't know, decades, and but a number of years, with X number of profs who have been named internally within the university structure as regents professors with additional compensation.
Yes.
So how's that reconciled? And again, maybe you're not the person to ask, but how's that reconciled? I haven't had a chance to ask the governor that, but I'm curious from your perspective.
Senator Robing, Senator Cohen, I don't think I know the answer to that. The regents, there are very, very few regents professors. It's the most distinguished rank one can achieve. And these are people of remarkable accomplishment. In many cases, remarkable teachers as well as remarkable researchers.
But ma'am, sure, isn't, again, Professor Sampson, I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but isn't that kind of the point, that with the regents professors, you have an acknowledgement of some first-rate professors. They get the honor, they get the regents chair within the university. They get additional compensation, and isn't that the incentive for the rest of the faculty and for the faculty who remain at the university for a number of years?
Senator Robing, Senator Cohen, I would agree that is an incentive. But I think I would reiterate that the whole merit-based salary thing means that everybody is operating, you know, whether you're at the very beginning levels as a brand-new assistant professor or whether you've been in rank as a full professor for a length of time, that every year your compensation is based on, you know, what have you done for me lately? In other words, what happened last year?
And Madam Chair, that's why
Senator Cohen,
I have to repeat myself. I might be putting the wrong person on the spot relative to this. As somebody who's been a distinguished member of the poli-sci department for a number of years and where, if I'm not mistaken, you've had the opportunity to teach at other schools. I mean, you've done work at Carleton, for instance, in the past. I'm not sure what that says to an individual faculty member, that if in a given year you end up teaching freshman whatever and you have a broader-based classroom performance level, it's not a senior honors program. I would assume if your compensation is going to be based upon your performance, that every prof in the college is going to want to teach the senior honors program because you're going to get a better product, a better performance out of those students than you will a broader-based freshman class, I'm assuming.
Mr. Sampson.
Senator Robing, Senator Cohen, I worry about that kind of thing, and I have the good luck to be in a department that I think sees it differently. I think most of us regard freshman courses as the most challenging ones to teach. And to some extent, they're the most important because this is the adjustment of people who, you know, presumably had to spend less time doing homework as high school people than they do as college people. I don't think there's any shortage of talent, you know, in the large undergraduate freshman classes. It's a challenge to me as an instructor to inspire and to unlock that talent. And in some respects, it's more enjoyable to do that than it might be to work with a very, very talented group of people, let's say, in an honors seminar of some kind. I mean, I enjoy that as well. But
Madam Chair, is my last comment. That's when I'm having some difficulty, though, wrapping my arms around what the governor has proposed in terms of this performance review, pay, whatever, that, you know, is it kind of a one-size-fits-all? And more difficult to implement as opposed to letting the university be a university.
Senator Robing, Senator Cohen, as I say, I need to go back and see exactly what the elements are. But my reaction is that the elements are a part of what, you know, a university ought to be judged on. I would prefer that the challenge be the entire broad array of things that we are expected to do well and that it, you know, it reach into whether it's teaching a large freshman class or whether it's other kinds of things. So,
sorry, I had like 50 fifth graders who wanted me to sit down for half an hour and talk about homelessness. Is that what you're doing, Senator Cohen?
Send them out. Madam Chair, mine were a little bit older than fifth graders.
Oh, so. Yeah, mine were fifth graders. So they all wrote me letters. That was nice. I told them they all had to go to college.
The question is where?
Yeah.
I said Minnesota.
Yeah,
oh, I said the University of Minnesota, excuse me. I think, are we done with Professor Sampson? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Then Matt Smith with the Graduate and Professional Student Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here today. Anticipating a late start to the committee hearing, I kept my prepared remarks brief. My name is Matt Schmidt, and I'm a dual degree master's student at both the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs and also the School of Public Health. Now, some of you may recognize me for the, I guess in a previous life, I was a legislative assistant for Senator Sharon Marco. And in retiring from this body, she joked that she felt like she was just receiving her graduate degree. Well, for better or for worse, I'm still working on mine. So in all seriousness, I'm here today as a member of the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, representing over 17,000 University of Minnesota graduate and professional students. Constituting approximately 35% of the student body, university graduate and professional students are enrolled in one of more than 10 different schools and close to 200 programs. The university's graduate and professional students have come from 50 states and over 118 countries. These students engage in rigorous training, balance hectic schedules and family obligations, and share a common goal, the sincere desire to make a meaningful contribution to society. Indeed, these students play a significant role in the sort of world-renowned research, award-winning teaching, and outstanding public service that the University of Minnesota is known for. As you might guess, these accomplishments don't happen by accident. As such, I'd like to recognize the great efforts of President Brunix and his administration in promoting ambitious drive and vision during a period of great uncertainty and instability. I should add that I've heard President Brunix present elements of the university's budget request three times now, and each time I've learned something new. More to the point, though, I've felt inspired by the university's past accomplishments and contributions, excited about its future growth and innovation, and darn proud to be a Golden Gopher. I can tell you that there's a lot of excitement on campus about the changing face of the university and its future promise. For instance, efforts to invest in emerging and cutting-edge areas such as the biosciences and nanotechnology to answer the call of growing national and global crises through renewable energy research and innovation and to retain our most talented faculty all come to mind. In addition, plans for a new on-campus Gopher football stadium and light rail transit will infuse an energy and connectedness on campus the likes of which I can only anticipate. Other aspects of the university's vision to create Minnesota's future are truly forward-looking and can be described as nothing short of inspiring. Despite all this hope and enthusiasm, I'd be remiss not to share with you a serious concern felt throughout all the student body, namely the pervasive effects of significant tuition increases over the course of the past several years. According to university numbers, graduate student tuition has nearly doubled in the past 6 years, with graduate tuition rates increasing an average of over 11% annually during this time. For graduate students matriculating in 2006, those relying upon student loans to complete their graduate programs incurred an average of $30,000 in additional debt. In general, it's often the case that students will incur more debt in 2 years of graduate coursework than in the 4 years previously as undergrads. For students driven to do good rather than to do well, this is a rude awakening indeed. With the exception of its medical and dental schools, University of Minnesota graduate and professional schools time and again rank among the Big Ten's top three in resident tuition and required fees for 2006-2007. Last year, roughly 90% of our professional students were graduated with significant debt, debt that ranged from an average of $74,000 for law school grads to an average of over $126,000 for students entering the dental profession. Unfortunately, these numbers are often understated because students borrow from other sources that are not tracked and reflected in these numbers. University figures also demonstrate that an overall number of students who incurred debt increased by 35% between fiscal year 2001 and fiscal year 2006. Moreover, the annual amount borrowed per student increased 50% during this time, and the total amount the university students borrow more than doubled from approximately $170 million in fiscal year 2001 to nearly $345 million in fiscal year 2006. In fairness, it should be noted that enrollment increases explain part, but certainly not all, of this incredible growth in total student borrowing. All told, my sense is that it'd be hard to deny this trend in tuition increases and student indebtedness is the result of deliberate policy decisions both at the state and federal levels of government. Of course, I'm not the first person to recognize this. This issue has been raised in the past, and it surfaced during the gubernatorial debates this fall. In addition, I'm sure that members of this committee have heard from their constituents or even experienced this trend firsthand with their sons or daughters. My message today, though, is that a period of consequence may be upon us. Despite higher education's value as a capital investment, an investment that has been shown to pay for itself many times over during a graduate's career in the workforce, no one knows the limiting effects that such significant student debt may play in a graduate's decision to own a home, to start a family, or to engage in a relatively non-lucrative career in public service, for instance. Fortunately, members, I'll leave that issue for another day and perhaps another committee. But again, in all seriousness, the mere sticker shock of rapidly increasing tuition may prove to limit the aspirations of America's next generation, a generation that will be competing not just among itself, but with the best and brightest throughout the world. Indeed, in this well-anticipated and frequently noted era of an increasingly competitive global economy and borderless workforce, we need to invest smartly in order to put our best foot forward, and frankly, to give our generation, our next generation, the chance to succeed that those before us have enjoyed. Members, as a matter of practicality, we fully understand the challenges before you. We know that $2 billion, separate one-time money and adjusted for inflation, is not the great sum that many believe it to be. And we know that there are numerous deserving and underfunded areas competing for scarce public dollars. However, we also recognize the role of Minnesota's institutions of higher education and their students and families played in addressing a historic state budget deficit. And we're concerned that a trend of decreasing tuition rate increases, does little to address the residual challenge of significantly increased tuition burdens. At a minimum, members, please recognize that the university's request already incorporates a pair of 4.5% tuition increases in the next biennium, and that the university is lean and efficient, yearning to continue its progress to become a top-notch 21st century model for research and teaching excellence. In short, members, as we all drive forward together, don't stop at the shiny exterior, as some might propose. Rather, provide this university with the engine it needs to get us through the challenging but exciting times ahead. Thank you, and with that, I'd be happy to take a crack at any questions you may have.
Questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, and I really am not sure of this answer, and I acknowledge that tuition has increased dramatically in the last 10-20 years, but how have salaries for those professionals done in comparison for the doctors and the dentists and the attorneys that are graduating from the graduate and professional programs that we have?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling,
Smith.
My understanding is that the salaries that these professionals or graduate students can anticipate to receive upon graduation has kept up with the tuition increases that they face. However, my concern is that this isn't true for all professions or all areas that graduate students might go into. And also, I'm very concerned about the sticker shock, the anticipation of having to incur $100,000 or $150,000 in debt for these professionals. I think that although the salaries tend to keep up, that's not always the case. And I really do worry that it's limiting and it's an intimidating burden for a lot of young students to face.
One of the research presentations yesterday in the Rotunda, I think the student was from St. Ben's, and they had an assumption that higher education, there was a correlation between higher education and salaries, and which we think, we all say there is, and the research that she had done said it was flat. There was not a correlation unless you went into a tech field, a high-tech field. So I thought that was pretty shocking from what we've been thinking. I think we're going to be, when we do our workshop, I think we're going to be pretty shocked by a lot of the information that we hear about Minnesota. Any questions for Mr. Schmidt? Okay. Well, hope to see you again here when you have in your spare time.
All right. Take care.
Right. Max Page. Oh, wait, he's not going to be here till a little bit later? Or he's here? Oh, you're here. Great. Good timing.
Actually, just walked in the door.
Hi, welcome to the committee.
My name is Max Page. I'm the president of the Minnesota Student Association, which is the undergraduate student government at the U of M. And thank you, Madam Chair and members. I know the university's here, as well as representatives, talking about the budget specifically, and I'm not as well versed in the months of work they put into that, so hopefully what I can provide is just a little perspective into what the undergraduate experience is like at the U of M, because it's a very unique one, and I think there's a bigger thing that's sometimes forgotten with all the talk about money and everything. And really what I want you to take away from this is that the university is the place, is, I'm convinced, the place in the state for opportunity. When you have students who are able to come to the university, who will never go to another country in their entire life, they have the opportunity to travel to Ireland or to Australia or South Africa. That's something that's very unique that we cannot forget. They can explore different ideologies, different cultures on campus as well. There's a very vibrant student group population. These are ways that students get involved and feel like there's a community in this huge university. And one example I always like to bring up is there's finally the opportunity for this advancement of our society, and that's the link, I think, that's often forgotten between the university and the rest of our state, and I'm going to argue right now even the world. Norman Borlaug, educated at the University of Minnesota, came up with farming techniques and ways of spreading those that people think have fed upwards of 1 billion people in the world. So if one out of every six people in the world can be affected by a university graduate, I think that sky's the limit, and that we should absolutely not forget that when we're talking about all these numbers. And while those opportunities do exist now, there are a significant number of barriers that are increasingly getting larger. And I think first and foremost, tuition is one of those. I personally have had four friends from the dorm I lived in freshman year, four friends who stayed close, but they've had to drop out of school for at least one semester. Some have dropped out indefinitely, and it's always due to the tuition increases. They're just not able to afford that. Those are both Wisconsin students coming in, as well as students from northern Minnesota, where I'm from. I think that's just unacceptable for our state. Those students who do stay in school are incurring tens of thousands of dollars of debt just from their undergraduate education. And while we like to see them go on and get their graduate and professional work done, it's another barrier that's going to stop them from pursuing those avenues of education. And that's not the kind of culture that Minnesota has traditionally had, and that's not the culture I think that we should create. I have one friend I live with is going to have approximately $40,000 coming out between living expenses, tuition. Another friend is $30,000. While those are not the average, the average is about, I believe, $20,000. And to have that kind of that weight, that burden upon leaving your undergraduate education, economically, I think it would hold our state back. Again, I don't have the statistics on the budget and everything, but it's just a common sense thing. And finally, I'd just like to address, while there's a number of offices who are increasingly helping students become comfortable in the setting at the university, I think we do a fine job adapting them to the big city lifestyle. There are challenges that students face as well, especially when it comes to costs of heating your house. A lot of the houses around the university are much older. The house I live in is built at least 80 years ago, and some of those issues affect students more greatly than they do other folks who live throughout the state. And so with those costs, energy costs increasing as well, it's another one of those burdens. And finally, some of the living conditions are just, I think a lot of us would be embarrassed to even go into them, let alone live in them. Just a few years ago, we had three students die from their house burning down. And while obviously those conditions are unacceptable, not having a smoke detector, and we have student legal services on campus to address those, we have a large campus, and it's impossible to get to all of those students. So with all of these concerns compounded, the tuition is something I think the state has a role in that could relieve some of that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Page?
Hey,
yes, Senator Wieger.
Yes, Mr. Page, what's your major? What do you plan on doing?
Mr. Page.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, I am, there's a unique program at the university where you can design your own major, and I'm doing that in journalism, political science, and film studies, and I just applied for the Teach for America program, and will hopefully be going to law school, applying to the university. They have a very good law school there.
Senator Wieger?
And Madam Chair, Mr. Page, discussion, it's well documented on the tuition. Is there much discussion by your student association about fees? You pay for that as well, and it's a chunk.
Sure, absolutely. And Madam Chair, Senator Wieger again, fees are something that fund organizations like mine, and I think really are able to add to the kind of campus culture that we have. And while those are increasing, I think students do realize the direct benefit they get from those. But I mean, again, it's something that that compounds into it and builds up as well. Maybe not as quickly as tuition, but absolutely does. Textbook costs are another one that's a very difficult issue for students to handle as well.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Senator Roebling, why don't we just get started? And I'm sure Ms. Hegard will join us soon. And you know, it's not that complicated. If you want to pull out your Senator Roebling's bill, Senate File 575, the governor's proposal, and we're looking at Section 5. It begins on page 8. Okay. Bottom of page 8. And also, if it's useful in terms of comparison, in the this booklet that we got from the university, Driven to Discover, the second to the last page in the packet does have a comparison with the university's request. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The governor's bill does include a number of the requests that are included in the bills you were presenting. Some of them in their entirety, and this is very similar to the Minsky proposal, and some of them partial, although I think most of them are in entirety or else they're zeroed out. For example, the competitive compensation is included in the governor's proposal, and the health, workforce, and clinical sciences is fully funded. The science and engineering proposal is fully funded according to the request from the university, and the environment, ag systems, and renewable energy is. The Senator Tomasoni's provision, though, for the compensation is not funded in the governor's proposal, and Senator Cohen's proposal for advancing education is not funded. And that is a collection of a variety of requests that relate to all the university's undergraduate program and library, Institute for Advanced Study, and those sorts of things. And so, oh, here they
Ms.
are.
Good. We just got started, so catch your breath. Senator Roebling will talk a little bit.
Helping me out from the higher ed office. And so there's also in the governor's proposal, overall it's $153 million for the biennium. And that's an increase of 15.2% over the current biennium. $90 million of that is in ongoing funding, and $63 million is in one-time funds. And that breaks down to $38 million to the U of M Mayo Partnership for Biotechnology, and that's all one-time money. $3.45 million each year for technology. And then, as I mentioned before, we have $9.8 million for differential compensation increases. This would be more for the recruiting, for the amounts you have to pay over and above, perhaps to get the top faculty that you're looking for. $8.8 million in 2008 and $19.1 million in 2009 for health and clinical sciences, and then $4.1 million in 2008 and $11.5 million in 2009 for science and engineering. And then we have the request for the Environment, Ag, and Energy was $3.1 million in 2008 and $8.4 million in 2009. Now, there's a provision in here, which I was talking to Professor Sampson about the performance payment of $25 million. And that is all one-time million, all one-time money, $25 million, and the university would have to attain three or more of the goals. And as we were talking earlier, some of those would be to increase the national faculty awards, maintain or improve the university's rank in the national share of funding for the NIH, increase of 5% in postdoctoral appointees, increase of 5% in financial support for renewable energy research, and an increase in 5% in high-value licenses to Minnesota-based businesses or venture-quality startup companies in Minnesota, which has been a goal for a long time, and we know the university is currently working in that direction and hoping to expand their licenses. We've heard reports that there are some patents already out there, and we're hoping to get more licenses in place. And so that is kind of the basic information on the budget proposal. We, of course, do not have a policy set in the U of M budget proposal because the Board of Regents, being a land-grant university, they determine that themselves. And we do not set policy like we do for the Minscu budget. But the university is also proposing a 4.5% tuition increase. And when you think about that, if it actually could be enough to cover a 2% salary increase each of those years. So I am thinking that I haven't had this personal discussion with the governor, but if that indeed takes place, that would help cover some of those ongoing inflationary salary increases that he did not fund. So I will turn it over to Ms. Hegard and let her fill in some of the other finer points.
Welcome. How'd it go in the House?
Madam Chair, I apologize that I was late. We haven't yet figured out how to clone ourselves, so I have a feeling that this will happen again. But it went fine over there, and I apologize again for missing the beginning of this. I don't know whether I have much to add other than just some context sort of points, but I'd be happy to answer questions. I think, you know, the criticisms, of course, of the budget proposal that the governor's put forward is if it's not enough money, it ought to be more. And we hear, you know, folks talk about kind of how to catch up from when these cuts occurred in the past. I think what he's put on the table, you know, is roughly my notes here, a 10%, you know, increase over base that is ongoing. If you add in the 25% one-time money, the $25 million one-time money and the $25 million one-time money, that increases it slightly, but the ongoing money is a 10% increase. Another criticism is that it's tipped to certain areas. You know, why did you fund strategic things and not the core function? And I think the governor's feeling is that this is the beginning of a process, that he felt it was his duty to make sure that the university in particular strategically focused. He was very pleased with their budget recommendation and proposal, the way they laid out their budget. He was pleased with Minscu's as well. But it was important for him to strategically focus the money in line with the way that they'd laid it out in their own budget. And then I think third, of course, a criticism on the money is, you know, why are you looking at performance funding? And I think his feeling was that, I think you heard it in the State of the State thematically, that he'd like to try to see more performance across state government and across state spending. The idea here is that it would be linked directly to elements inside of the university's strategic plan, things that are reachable for them and particular to them, not things that are statewide. That's a very different thing. So those are sort of the three criticisms, of course. And I guess just given the changing demographics of the state that we're facing, both in terms of age and the new and different kinds of students that are coming into our education systems, the type of people that we're going to be leaning on later in our lives to help support us with taxes, I think he still feels that he needs to be generous yet conservative. And that's the reason for his the way that he structured his budget proposal.
You know, I don't want to get us off topic, but while you're there, I just want to mention one thing. I got a letter from the governor. It was kind of the be careful I might veto something letter, in which he repeated a line that is not true. And I just wish that you would tell him and other people would tell him to please stop saying that. He's saying that the DREAM Act provides a benefit to undocumented students that is not available to a student from Iowa. A student from Iowa who moves here to go to school establishes residency after 1 year of being in Minnesota. The DREAM Act requires 3 years of residency plus graduating from a Minnesota high school. We are not offering any benefit to a student from Iowa that's better than what we're offering to an undocumented student who's grown up in Minnesota and gone to a Minnesota high school. So, I mean, he certainly has the right to his own opinion about how he feels about undocumented students, but I wish he would not use this as his excuse for being opposed to it. He could find some other reasons.
Madam Chair, I have not had a chance to see that letter. I will get a copy of that so that I can review it.
We'll make sure that you get a copy of it.
And as I've testified in the past, the governor is opposed to the DREAM Act. I've testified before you to that effect, that his preference is that something be dealt with at the federal level. I think there's hope that there may be some resolution at the federal level with some of the immigration reform that they're considering.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, comments from members of the committee? Then why don't we hear from the University of Minnesota? This section is fairly simple, self-explanatory. President Brunix.
Chair Pappas, members of the committee, I want to begin by thanking my most eloquent colleagues. If I had known they were going to be so eloquent, I would have put them up first. I thought they just did a spectacular job, faculty and students, and you can see why I'm so proud of them. I'd like to make just a couple of comments about the governor's budget. I must tell you, I appreciate some aspects of the recommendation, and I'll talk about those in just a moment. I don't think it's sufficient to move the university forward. It's at best a status quo budget, and I think actually with this budget we'll lose ground, and I'd be happy to get into the deep discussion as to why. H. Ross Perot, when he was running for president, had all those charts, remember, in 1992, and he said a vision without resources just could be an hallucination. And I think what we're putting before you is a vision for the future of the University of Minnesota that is tied to the vision we ought to hold for our state. We ought to have high aspirations for this state being a leader in the global knowledge-based economy, and we shouldn't settle for anything less. Now, a lot of percentages have been thrown out. 15% was one that I just heard. And you can look at the mathematics of budgeting in a lot of different ways, but a simple way to break this down is the governor's recommendation is approximately $20 million below the appropriation we received in the last biennium. 50% of what the university asked for, and I fully recognize that it's the job of a governor and the job of a legislature to set priorities, and you don't always get what you ask for, and certainly that has been the case for the University of Minnesota. The problem with sorting out this budget, and I want to draw your attention to this page, is that it's a mixture of recurring funding, one-time bonus funding provided you meet goals and objectives. And I want to address that particular concern because I want to make it crystal clear that this is a university that cares deeply about results and deeply about accountability. So I won't say anything that is, I think, contrary to what I think the governor is trying to achieve with this part of his budget. But the recurring increase is under 5% each of the 2 years. When you talk about the budget and the costs of the university, the operating costs and the investment budget of the university, it roughly provides about 4.8 4.7% 1 year and about 4.7 the first year, 4.9% the second year. If you add in the performance bonus, which is a one-time bonus, it doesn't meet recurring operating costs. Now, I can tell you, we can spend as much one-time money as you want to send to the University of Minnesota, but we can't budget it in the out years. To me, that's worse than fuzzy math. You know, that's adding to the debt burdens and the potential tuition increases in the out years. And we don't budget that way. The regents of the University of Minnesota don't allow it, and I wouldn't put a budget before them that had those kinds of numbers. So even in the throes of the deep budget cut that was $185 million over 2 years, 15% of our base budget, the largest kind of reduction given to any sector in the state budget, and that was true of Minsku and the University of Minnesota, we did not use reserves. We did not do cost shifting. We balanced our budget. We made the painful decisions, including the decisions that Matt so eloquently talked with you about in raising tuition over this short period of time. But we can't balance the budget that way, and we can't pay people 2 to 3 years from now on money that doesn't exist. You know, it has to be built into the base, or we have to have some reasonable prospect of funding it. So I appreciate where I like the governor's recommendation is he recognizes, I think, the important research mission and responsibilities of the University of Minnesota. He recognized that the priorities we put in the budget were good ones. They were sound. They were priorities that we needed to address in the future. Funding for technology and technology infrastructure is absolutely critical to the university and the state. Funding these academic priorities, I think, are really important. But the core operating costs were just not covered. Now, let me say something about tuition. Tuition is embedded in these numbers. And so the 4.5% is covering costs related to compensation and advancing education. There's another $30+ million of internal reallocation that is meeting building and operating costs. And so the university is putting those numbers into its budget. And I just feel quite strongly that this is a you can throw 15% out there, but it's not a 15% base budget increase for the University of Minnesota. It's not anything close to that. It is, you can argue, somewhat above the CPI. But the expenses of a university with respect to technology and the people who work in the university isn't close to the CPI today. It's much more in the range of, 6 to 7% a year. Now, I want to make one additional comment. There's $38 million of one-time money in the Mayo University partnership, and I think my colleagues here at the university and the representatives from the greater Rochester area will recognize that what I'm going to say is absolutely the way in which we put this together, and the governor agrees in a subsequent conversation I had with him. When this partnership was set up, it was agreed that it was to go through the budget of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Hugh Smith, who was then the CEO of Mayo, and Frank Serra, our senior vice president for academic health, testified several times when those bills went through over a 2 to 3 year period. I believe those bills are now traveling on a separate path, and I believe the funding proposal is $15 million recurring so that we can establish this very flourishing partnership on a long-term basis. And I've shared those perceptions and recollections with the governor. My sense is that he's comfortable with that position, as is Commissioner McElroy. But anyway, those are traveling a separate bill. And you might say, well, it's money to the university. Well, it's money, about $7.5 million to the university, $7.5 million to Mayo on a long-term basis. To really bring partnerships together that can be used to leverage new funding into the state of Minnesota and new opportunities for technology development and commercialization. In the first 2 years of this investment, $4 million that was put up by the state, Mayo, and the University of Minnesota generated a $25 million increase alone in NIH grants. So I think it's a good thing to do. I think it was visionary for all of us to come together and make this commitment. But I don't think that should be considered part of the university's core operating budget, and it was never It was never proposed in that way, and I think all the parties now agree it needs to travel on this separate course and on this separate path. So just to say a couple of very quick things in summary, you know, I think there are some parts of the governor's recommendation that I find affirming. I think they strongly affirm the importance of the university and its mission. But I think it falls far short of what we need to maintain the operating costs of the university and to make the necessary investments that I believe are absolutely essential to move this university forward at this time. This is the first time in years, that is since the Ventura administration, that we have had any surplus in the operating budget of the University of Minnesota, and I find it somewhat puzzling that the base budget increase is $20 million, the recommendation in this budget is $20 million lower than the university's result in the last biennium when we had many more budgetary challenges before us. I'd like to make a couple of comments about the accountability provision. I don't think there's a university in the United States today that cares more about accountability, that practices the principles of accountability, or believes in the importance of accountability more than the University of Minnesota. So I don't have a problem being challenged as a university community to step up and meet measurable results. And if the legislature decides to do that, I think that's fine. But again, I want to point out that's going to take care of one-time expenditures. And if you look at these measures, and I would argue there are other ones we ought to consider, quite frankly, and I think the Office of Higher Education and the Governor's Office would be open to that discussion, I would argue these are measures and results that come as a result of long-term recurring investment, and they cannot be accomplished with one-time funding. And so while I welcome the challenge of accountability, and I think we're up to it, I showed you a whole chart with 20 measures, and that's just the tip of the iceberg at the University of Minnesota. We benchmark everything. I believe you measure what you value, and you work to improve your performance each and every day. I frankly don't think that's a good long-term strategy to fund the University of Minnesota, and I think that's what Senator Cohen was addressing in his questions. But at the same time, I do think it is appropriate for the state to hold the university accountable for results, and I welcome that kind of conversation and the conversation that leads to the kind of accountability framework that I think Susan Hegart is developing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The tuition issue is obviously difficult. We talked about textbook costs, fees, things of that sort. We actually decreased fees on students last year. We try to be very disciplined about the assessment of fees. We want to make sure that those fees really are benefit, you know, their entire quality of life as students. But these are all areas and costs that I think affect our students and their families, and they do deserve some attention. I would say the very best way to hold down tuition costs at the University of Minnesota is to support the core budget, because if you do that, we will do our best to lower costs and to restrain the growth of tuition. I can tell you that it is not fun for me to bring a double-digit tuition increase forward. I run the gauntlet with all the student groups, and they can tell you that, along with Vice Provost Swan and the Provost Tom Sullivan, who's behind me. And it's very, very difficult, particularly with the graduate and professional fields that we have. Our medical school tuition last year did not go up by the what was roughly, I think, 6.5%, because we were already priced at the top of the market, and we simply didn't feel that our students could sustain those kinds of increases. So what happened in that case is the medical school ate the difference, and they ate it by cutting the budget, and I think compromising in part their competitiveness. So I can promise you we'll do our part to restrain the growth in tuition. I have some personal opinions about where I would invest money to try to solve some of those problems, but I think the first priority ought to be to to fund the core budget. By doing so, I think we have every possibility to keep these tuition rates under control. There is a chart that I shared with you the last time. I just want to close with very quickly. And this is a part of what we try to do is to benchmark our spending. And if you look at this chart, it represents the state budget, the state allocation, and the tuition dollars that we collect here at the University of Minnesota across our system. And those costs have gone up in this roughly seven-year period, 4.3%. States' costs have gone up nearly 5%. I think even given the what I'd consider to be extraordinary cost pressures on higher education that I think are quite a bit higher than they are in other parts of the economy, I think this chart shows that the university is trying to keep these costs under control, and I think we need to do that. We need to be a part of the solution as well. We can't just come here and ask you for money. We need to look at ways to drive down fuel costs, to deal with the increasing costs of textbooks. Vice Provost Swan, who was here this morning, met with all the undergraduate deans, academic deans on the Twin Cities campus to talk about this issue today. That is the rising cost of textbooks and what we can do as an academic community to restrain those costs. Right. So I think we do bear some responsibility here. But the takeaway here, I think, is that during this period, including some adversity, the university did a very good job of keeping its costs under control, and I think keeping them actually under the cost levels of the state of Minnesota. Well, let me stop here, and if you have questions, I'd be delighted to answer them. I really appreciate the opportunity to come before you with my colleagues. This has been a great two-day hearing on the university's budget, and we look forward to working with you as the session unfolds.
Thank you. Thank you very much for spending the time with us. It does seem to me, if you go back to the first three bars, where the state was paying 70%, the third bar 67% of the cost of instruction, and tuition was 33%, then we ran into some hard times, and so the tuition started taking over more of the cost. And then it looked like we're kind of back on an upward trend the last 2 years again, except with the governor's proposal. So I personally think that we need to continue on that upward trend so we get back to a place where the state is paying two-thirds of the cost of instruction. The students are only paying one-third. So that's, I don't know. That's my personal opinion. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And you're right. We're on an upward trend. But it seems like the expenditures are on an even greater upward trend. And I think that's probably what I'm having a hard time getting my hands around is we look at the Consumer Price Index, and you alluded to it just a little bit ago, President Brunix, that you feel that your costs need to be much higher, more than double the increase in the Consumer Price Index. And I struggle to understand why that should be. We're facing it in healthcare costs. We understand that and see that, but I'm struggling with the idea that you're requesting $95.5 million in additional money for salaries for compensation. Then that doesn't include what money would be coming in from tuition.
Yes, it does. Tuition is fully loaded into those numbers.
But you're asking the state for $67 million in regular compensation increases, and then competitive compensation is $28.5 million. Does that includes tuition? I didn't understand that it did.
Because the total compensation cost is $104 million. So we are paying for part of those costs with tuition increases. And we're paying for part of the cost of advancing education, that is the investment budget there through tuition. So when you fully load those costs for compensation, for example, it's $104 million, and that difference, that is the difference between the state request and $104 is most of that is tuition. But let me just, I think you ask a very good question. Excuse me, I forgot my protocol, but Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling.
President
Brunix. I think you ask a very good question. So what is the Consumer Price Index? It's a basket full of goods and services that economists use to assess the growth of costs in the economy on an annual basis. It has a very strong weighting on housing, on food, on fuels, and a lot of other things that you would find also in the cost structure of the University of Minnesota. But when you go to the University of Minnesota and you look at its budget is driven more by something called the Higher Education Price Index. And that's not some fanciful number. I'd be happy to send you the economic model for the Higher Education Price Index. But what it does is it more fairly weights the components that drive the costs of higher education. And what are they? They're obviously people. And if you look at the, let's say, a dollar of the university's budget, 70 cents of every dollar goes into the hiring and support of people, our students, faculty, and staff. And so it weights that factor much higher than the Consumer Price Index, which basically deals with the cost increases that we all experience year to year in our economy. It also weights technology investment. Universities like the University of Minnesota, if we're going to be a participant in the National Lambda-Rail Initiative, which brings high-speed computing to the University of Minnesota and to our entire state, that requires much more backbone and infrastructure investment than you would find in the typical household in any neighborhood of our communities. And so if you look at these different components, the Higher Education Price Index, not because people just want to increase prices, but the actual costs, library costs, technology costs, personnel costs, are running approximately 50% on an annualized basis above the CPI. So that's one thing to consider. So you could say, well, just live with the Higher Education Price Index. The university is living with the Higher Education Price Index. We live with it every year, and we try to control those costs to the best of our ability. But what we're also coming here and saying to you is we can't maintain the University of Minnesota, the productivity profile that we have at the University of Minnesota, without also renewed investment. And this has been a period of absolutely stagnant investment when it comes to funding the future of the University of Minnesota. I just had a conversation with one of the leading executives of one of the major medical device firms in Minnesota, and he tells me that his company is deciding to build a major research laboratory in Shanghai. Okay? Now, if we don't think the world is flat, this is a really great example. We're moving a major laboratory that deals with chemical engineering, material science, and related fields from Minnesota to Shanghai because it's cheaper, and Shanghai actually is making more investment than we are in this area. And in our own backyard, we have the number one or two ranked department of its kind in the entire country, if not the entire world. And when I go to China, they want to talk to me about the Department of Chemical Engineering and Materials Science at the University of Minnesota. If we don't continue to invest in it, it will be in Shanghai rather than in our own backyard. So you're right. You could say, let's just do the Higher Education Price Index. Let's fund you at the CPI. But this will be a budget without any imagination, without any vision for Minnesota's future, without any investment that is necessary to keep the best and the brightest people here, and also to make the investments that I think are necessary to create our future.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair and President Brunix, I had a question kind of along those lines, and but Senator Roebling's question offers the segue. And it's a difficult question. I want to find out if there's any recognition on the part of the governor, because my sense has been, and we've had these conversations both when I've been in this division previously and certainly with yourself and other people from the university, but it strikes me that the difficulty, it's an elitist argument. It comes across as an elitist argument. We've got a first-rate higher education system in Minnesota. You know, in fact, we have Senator Sharon sitting here, who's a professor at Minnesota State at Mankato, which is an excellent state university. But the land-grant research university of a state, it strikes me as in a national, if not international, competitive market for faculty. and the difficulty center enrollment. I want to find out if the governor has any recognition of this, because when you look at your chart with the comparison between the university request on compensation and the governor's recommendation on compensation, I'm assuming, to my right, Senator Michelle went to Dartmouth College, and I assume that the University of Minnesota is competing with Dartmouth for faculty members, and that if you're going to try to maintain a competitive edge, you're not just simply competing with, the University of North Dakota. You're competing with Dartmouth to try to maintain faculty members from leaving, and it becomes an elitist argument. Or it sounds like it might be an elitist argument, Senator Roebling, but unless you can, I assume, have that kind of competitive edge, you lose those people. It's kind of like, we had to build a baseball stadium, which, to be fair, I voted against. So the Minnesota Twins could sign, the high-priced free agents and get the pitchers and the first baseman. I guess I'm not as concerned about that as I am the University of Minnesota keeping the engineering profs and the poli-sci profs and the lit profs and so on. Is there any recognition of that on the part of the governor, who happens to be a University of Minnesota graduate?
I will take that as a rhetorical question.
No, no.
Or to be answered, because I don't think the president needs to answer that, and our time is up. And Senator Cohen needs to move that Senate File 933 be recommended to pass, but laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
And Senator Cohen.
For the record.
Yes.
That's not a rhetorical question.
But I don't think it's a question for the president. It's a question for the governor. And I think we will have Ms. Hegard back up talking about the rest of the Office of Higher Education proposal, and I think you can pose that to her. She was up here before, and you were out of the room, and now we're out of time. Meeting is
adjourned.
Senator
Pappas,
President.
I do want to say that I could really use your help on campus as well.
I don't get that.
Protecting me from myself.
Oh, okay. I got it.